Welcome to the Aquariumax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 30, recorded May 24th, 2010.
Buonasera a tutti!
Good evening! Welcome once again to our podcast. We had a comment this week from Brian. Thank you, Brian, for writing in. To paraphrase this here, he's been keeping fresh and saltwater tanks for quite a few years, and he has a refugium tank with his reef tank, but he hasn't ever heard of anybody doing it with a freshwater tank, and he was wondering if we have ever hooked up a refugium kind of tank to any of our freshwater tanks. So Russ is going to answer that and tell us a little bit about refugiums, what they are, and that sort of thing.
For those of you who may not be familiar with what a refugium is, or a refugium, depending on how you pronounce it, some people pronounce it one way, some the other. I usually say refugium. But Brian made some mention of what it is. It's a separate container, or sometimes it's within the main tank, or it can be outside of it. But basically it's attached to it in such a way that it functions as part of the ecosystem without being completely being free travel of all organisms between both sections, so to speak. If you have an external refugium, for example, you have water flowing from your main tank into the refugium and then back out into the main tank, but most organisms, the larger organisms you keep in your aquarium, cannot travel freely into or out of the refugium, but small organisms can. In marine tanks, these are notably things like amphipods and copepods and isopods, things like that, that are common in marine tanks. And the advantage there is that they can populate the refugium, and then their larvae and so on, small specimens and even adults, occasionally get out to the main tank, and because they're constantly reproducing, you're constantly replenishing the large tank with low levels of these pods, as they're often affectionately called, that then help benefit the ecosystem in your main tank as a food source and so on. You can also do other things with it. Of course, many people keep things like Chaetomorpha algae in there that grows with a separate light source inside the refugium, which helps stabilize the ecological conditions in the tank and so on. But of course, Brian's question is about in doing this in freshwater. And I have done things like this in freshwater to some extent, so I'll give sort of an overview of that. I think the most common type of refugium-like structure that's done in freshwater tanks is a veggie filter, where you have a certain amount of your aquarium water that's pumped into a separate container that is either provided with artificial light or allowed sunlight, something like that, in which you grow a lot of plants that are emergent. In other words, they're out of the water, or part of the plant is out of the water, and this allows those plants to access atmospheric CO2 at a higher concentration than they would underwater. And the fact that they can do that speeds their growth and allows them to grow at a higher rate than they would in the water if they were completely underwater. And basically this removes nitrates and other similar wastes from your water. And people will do that, and often they will keep other creatures in the veggie filter, and this can these creatures can sometimes get back into the main tank and so on. And those would include amphipods, which are very common in freshwater, and copepods, too. I think, although I have kept freshwater isopods, I think they're, you see them show up less commonly in aquaria than amphipods or copepods do. Now, I have set up some sumps, which are similar to a refugium, but the purpose is kind of different. The purpose of a sump generally is filtration, where the purpose of a refugium is to allow creatures, like I mentioned before, to function as part of the ecosystem without allowing other creatures to feed on them and so on, give them kind of a protected place, which is what refugium means, to be able to reproduce. They do sometimes serve both purposes. Someone can have a sump that contains a refugium or a sump that functions as a refugium and so on. But basically, the main purpose of a sump, if that's all you have, is to filter. And you can put things like heaters and filters and skimmers inside a sump so it's not in the main display and helps the main display to stay less cluttered. It also gives you more volume, more water volume, and so you have a lower bio load for your entire system if you have all of your big organisms in your display tank, but then you add this sump that's just giving you bigger surface area for denitrification, filtration, and so on, that kind of thing. Anyway, I have built mini sumps. When I say mini, I'm saying M-I-N-I. I haven't done a lot of them, but I've done a couple of them. Very small sumps, miniature sumps for small tanks. The first one, I had a 0.5 gallon freshwater planted tank, and I built a sump for it that was about a gallon, and had water pumping from the main tank into the sump and then back into the other tank, where the filtration was taking place basically in the sump, and it was just pumping water in and out. And I did maintain some snails and so on in the sump, but later on I built one that was a little bigger. Well, actually, I think the sump was about the same size. It was a gallon, but the system was bigger because it was about a 4.5 gallon tank. And in this one, I had snails and copepods. I think I had a couple of Taiwan blue shrimp in there. And I had, amphipods and Dero worms, D-E-R-O worms, that lived in there. And a dwarf puffer in the 4.5 gallon tank. And the amphipods, the snails, and all the other creatures that were in there seem to periodically get through the system out of the sump and into the main tank, so it did function as a refugium as well, and it seemed to work fine. The voracious nature of the dwarf puffer and the small nature of the system and the low amount of energy going into the sump itself, it wasn't lit or anything, so there wasn't photosynthesis helping to drive the system, the energy in the system or anything, meant that there wasn't a really high production of these creatures, but some of them did get into the main tank and the puffer ate them. So it did work, it just didn't work on a very high speed or very intense scale, so to speak, as it might in a marine tank with a more light on the refugium, but it did work to some extent. So yes, I've done that, and it worked. I've also tried a couple of other things. One, I don't even remember why I started this, but I had a breeding trap, and I keep breeding traps around, just the little acrylic slotted containers. I keep those around even though I don't use them for live bears, which is their intended purpose. I don't think they work all that well for live bears, but they work great for certain other things. So I keep some around. And I don't remember why I started this, but when we lived in Hawaii, I had a tank that had one of these breeding traps hanging in, and I set some Pellia in there, which is Monocelium tenarum, the scientific name. It's a liverwort. It's a plant that is sort of like moss. But it's not a moss, but it's related to a moss. Anyway, for those of you who don't know about Pellia, something like a funky sort of seaweedy looking moss, I guess, would be one way to put it. Anyway, I set some Pellia in there, and it was a moderately lit tank, but it also received a little bit of light from the window that was nearby. And I noticed really soon that this Pellia started to grow like crazy. I mean, it really went to town, did amazingly well, and amphipods showed up in there, living in the Pellia and eating the Pellia, but because the Pellia was growing so fast, it didn't matter. And the occasional snail would show up in there as well. I did have a dwarf puffer in the main tank, and I'm sure that some of these amphipods and snails made their way into the puffer's capacious maw, so to speak. But the Pellia did really well, and it didn't do as well in the main tank. There were critters in there that would nibble on it, but it did great there. So it worked as a refugium for those three species, for the pond snails, the pellia, and the amphipods. So based on this, I decided I would try a snail refugium in a dwarf puffer tank. I'd just take one of these same breeding traps and set it in a puffer tank, put a few snails in it, feed the snails, and figuring that the snails would benefit from the fact that they're in this container where their droppings would fall through, the water is constantly being circulated, it was near a filter, and so there was a little current that was drawing water in and out of the breeding trap and so on. I figured that would work well, and the snails would breed, but they were adults, wouldn't be able to escape through the slots, but the babies would escape through the slots, and the puffers would eat the babies. I thought, wow, this sounds great, this is going to be cool. But it didn't work, because the snails would crawl on the slats and the puffers would pick at them, and then they would die, and then
naughty puffers.
It didn't work. So there's a project for those of you who might want to try that, figure out a way to do that a little bit better. I haven't tried in a while, but I would figure if you could separate the system a little better so that there were more space for the snails and they were more protected from the puffers, you could probably get that to work. So that's about it for my experience with refugia in freshwater. So let's move on to our next point.
Okay, Russ noticing about the grindleworms this evening that he wanted to share with you all.
Yeah, well, I don't think I've mentioned this before, but we've got three types of grindleworm cultures in our house. We've got a big redworm / grindleworm combo culture that spends about half the year in the garage and half the year outside.
The redworms are our composting worms. We feed them our kitchen scraps, basically, and they turn it into lovely fertilizer for the garden.
Yes, and so we feed them on paper egg cartons, shredded black and white paper, bits of newspaper, and most types of kitchen waste, largely
vegetable
and cereal type things, but they'll eat eggshells and all kinds of stuff. We put those in there, but a couple of years ago I thought, I wonder what would happen if I put a few grindleworms in this culture with the redworms, and so I did, and the worms, interestingly enough, not only do they thrive, but they reach a larger adult size than they do in any other culture that I've kept of any kind. They require very little maintenance, and after feeding something like oatmeal, which the grindleworms really go for, I can reach in there and just grab chunks, big chunks of pure worms that have been feeding on this. And they're very large. I've had grindleworms, and these are grindleworms. These are not white worms, ladies and gentlemen. These are grindleworms that are an inch long sometimes, which is pretty crazy. You usually don't see them that big.
They're a little bit darker in color.
Yeah, they're generally darker in color. And the fish really go nuts over those. Hiro, our African clawed frog, even likes them. They're big enough for him to be interested in. But you can imagine how crazy the angelfish and the guppies and the coolie loaches and, you know, everybody goes nuts over these. So I even give some to my marine tank sometimes, and they go for them as well. So anyway, that's the big redworm combo culture. And then we have soilless cultures. And the main advantage here, the worms are a little smaller than they are in the big combo culture, but they're still bigger than they are in most of the coconut fiber cultures. But the main advantage is that they're entirely pest-free. They do require more maintenance, but they're entirely pest-free. Nothing shows up in there. I don't get mites, I don't get thrips, I don't get fungus gnats, nothing. The big combo culture does have mites in it. It gets fruit
flies
in it.
The redworm and the grindleworm.
The redworm and the grindleworm one gets mites
and fruit
flies.
Lest you worry, we don't sell grindles out of, so
yeah,
we don't pass along any little nasties.
And that's why we keep it in the garage and outside, so that we don't get the bugs in the house. But the soilless cultures are the only ones that we sell from, just to keep the cultures we sell pest-free, and to keep the house
pest-free.
And that works great. I think soilless cultures are the way to go as far as that goes. If you want to produce large quantities of worms that are pest-free, and they do produce plenty of worms for the fish as well. We also have the coconut fiber cultures, which work well because we can start them from pest-free stock, which is what we have in the soilless cultures, and they're easier to ship than soilless cultures, and they're also less maintenance. You need to change the water in a soilless culture every other day or every few days at the least. You don't need to do that with a coconut fiber culture, and so they're easier as far as maintenance and shipping. But the thing I wanted to mention is that I took some worms out of the big culture, which is why I gave that background today. Just grabbed some chunks of worms.
Out of the red worm combo culture,
and they were huge and everything. Put them in a bottle to sort of decant them, get them cleaned off so I could feed them to the fish, because they do tend to be a little dirtier from that culture too. And there was a cotton swab in there that I must have left in the bottle from before, so I guess it's not all that inexplicable, but there you go. It was in there, and I left the worms and rinsed them off a couple times, came back and looked in there, and the big chunk of grindleworms had attached itself to this cotton swab. So I'm wondering, very, very much so. They were firmly entrenched in it. They had been attracted to it. So I'm wondering if that might be an interesting way to collect them in the future, and I'm going to look into that. If that could be useful for something. I don't know. They were just very attracted to it. And I pulled it out, and there was this solid glob of grindleworms attached to it. So I stuck it into one of the angelfish aquariums, and the angelfish came and slurped it off.
Head spaghetti.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. So
we will keep you posted on whether that turns into something.
Yeah, it may or may not. We'll see.
And we're going to talk about one more thing this evening, and that is the fish that Russ has trained at his office.
Yes. Now, I don't have a lot of time to deal with my fish at my office. Usually, maybe something like 4 minutes a day, all told, except on the day when I change the water, and it takes, 5 minutes to change the water, because I have to work. But I do have those 4 minutes a day, and that's enough to train the fish to do some interesting things. So we're going to give a little background on that, talk about how that works. And Kelly, if you have any comments you'd like to throw in or anything, please feel free to do that, as always. First of all, clicker training. That is the method that I use. If those of you who have dogs are familiar with clicker training from that, the principles work well with fish as well. They work well with everything. I mean, we've trained rats with it. We trained our budgie, our parakeet, with it. We trained our cat with it. Now, we do have a cat that will sit on command reliably based on that type of training. He will also come and touch your finger when on command, wherever it is. He'll climb up the ladder of a bunk bed on command to do that. Down the ladder, he'll go anywhere in the house to touch your finger on command based on that. And he'll sit either on a hand signal or a verbal command, and he does it reliably. Let's see, our budgie would say certain words on command. He would come when called very reliably. We had him on a certain command, he would climb up a ladder and ring a bell. All kinds of things that he would do based on this training. And it works well with fish, but you don't use a clicker. With the rats, the budgie, and the cat, we used a audible clicker. With the fish, instead, we use a little flashlight that when you hold down the button, the light's on, but when you let go, it turns off, because you need to have it flash quickly and then stop. So I got one of those flashlights for a couple of dollars, just a little keychain flashlight that you hold down. Now, I also have a teeny little spoon that came with the food, the betta food. And that's kind of important too, because you need to be able to regulate the quantity of food and be able to deliver the food. It's kind of time sensitive how you deliver the food, so that's important. But if you want to try this, all you need is a betta or some other fish, a very time specific manner of delivering the food, and something to signal the fish. Flashlight works well. Now, I'm not the one who came up with this, of course. Karen Pryor, if you go to, I think it's, you Google Karen Pryor and clicker training, she has an article about training fish that this is based on. There are other methods of training that are basically the same in principle, although the method is a little bit different. Online, there are famous fish training schools and so on. You can look that up too. If you look up fish school, I think one of the most famous ones comes up. Now, I'm not receiving any money to advertise either of those. I'm not advertising them, I'm just mentioning.
Maybe we can put some links on the resources page.
On the resources page, we can certainly do that. basically, this is what I did. Okay, the first period of training, as I would get a little bit of food on this tiny spoon and drop it on the water, I would watch carefully, holding the little flashlight up to the glass. And as soon as our beta Abraham, as soon as he grabbed onto that food, I flashed the light. And I would do that for, I did that for several days. That's all I did. Every time he grabbed a pellet, I would flash the light right at the moment. The timing is important. The precise moment they're grabbing onto that food, you need to flash the light. If you do it too early, it's bad. If you do it too late, it's bad too. Then, after you've done that for several days, then you lengthen the interval between that. You flash the light right before they get the food, but not much before. And then you gradually make the distance greater until you flash, and then a second or two later, you give the food. And by the time you're doing this, they realize that the light is a signal that food is coming. Okay? So what you do to test if this is working after you've done this for a week or so, you flash the light and then see if the fish reacts as if food is coming. And if the fish reacts as if food is coming, even if you aren't making any move toward putting food in the water, you know that they realize that that flash means food is coming. Then you can use that light flash to capture any behavior that the fish happens to be engaged in. And because when they see the light, they know food is coming, so they begin to associate any activity that they're engaged in when the light flashes with giving food. And so they'll begin to engage in those activities more frequently, which is called offering the behavior. So initially I began to teach the beta to target, which is just to approach an object, any specific object that you pick, and when the fish approaches that object, then you flash the light and then give the food pellet. My finger was the target, and it's natural if you hold your finger up to the tank that the beta will often approach it. So I did that, and when he approached, I flashed the light and gave him a treat, and I would do that for several times. And then I gradually started making it a little more difficult. I'd start moving my hand around and expect him to follow it before I would give him the food and so on. And soon he'd follow my finger fairly reliably around to different parts of the tank. And that's targeting, the first behavior that you can train. But then I trained something that was more fun and more interesting. Now, the little flashlight that I got happened to be red. And as many of you probably know, red is a color that excites male betas, because that's one of the primary colors of wild male betas. And so if something is red, they will tend to flare out their gill membranes and their fins and try to intimidate that red object, thinking that it's another male beta that they need to scare out of their territory. So initially I would hold up the flashlight and the beta would flare, and then I would flash the light and give it a treat. And pretty soon all I would have to do is show it a little part. I would decrease the amount of the flashlight that the fish would see until it was just seeing a little sliver of red, and then I would flash it when it flared. And then pretty soon I had hid the flashlight entirely behind my fingers, and the fish only saw the back of my hand. And now, all the fish has to see is the back of my hand. That's the signal, or the cue, and it will flare. Even though my hand looks nothing like a beta and is not a particularly intimidating color, as soon as it sees the back of my hand, it will immediately begin to flare. Now, I begin to shape that behavior so that after a while, I was demanding longer and longer periods of flaring. I wouldn't just, you know, drop a treat and flash the light and drop a treat as at the first sign of flaring. I would wait until the fish had been doing it for a while, parading from side to side in front of the tank, getting more and more excited about it. And then I waited until it would start doing tail beating, which is a natural behavior that betas do to intimidate each other. They kind of waggle back and forth, and the currents caused by that are easily felt by the other fish against their lateral line. And that is considered a way to show the strength of the fish. And so now the fish, not only does he flare and parade back and forth in front of the tank, but he tail beats, and then I give him a treat. So now he offers the tail beat, and he's in the process of learning how to do that perfectly, but he's now very frequently offers this tail beating behavior when I put my hand up, as well as flaring, which I'm going to train him further just by giving him treats only when he tail beats, as well as flaring, to engage in that behavior. And you can gradually shape almost any behavior. It is a behavior that naturally occurs in betas. The basic thing is, through this training, you can get him to perform that behavior on cue, and the cue is not what they would naturally respond to, and that's what's kind of fun about it. So if you want to try that, I would recommend reading some books on clicker training. I read several of them. I own a couple of them myself on clicker training. Karen Pryor is a great author, one of the pioneers in the field, so you can look her up and find some of her books. And it's amazing what fish can do with a little bit of training and, you know, 4 minutes or less a day. So give it a go.
Have fun.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com.
For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.